today, the perfect storm arrives. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today it's Friday, of course, and I'm joined by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you going?
Prepping for the lockdown, mate.
It's going to be a long run, I think. I don't think this is going to be over very short. And it's very, very interesting. There's a whole series of reversals underway at the moment and a series of pretty amazing contradictions.
Well, I mean, I suppose if you really look into it that deeply, there's been a lot of contradictions for quite a while now. But I think that they've been really caught by surprise on, you know, just how much this has spread despite the efforts that have been made to contain it.
Right. So a lot of this is, virus related. But I also think there's a broader set of issues. And I'm thinking particularly of what's going on in the US with the, the issue of treasuries notching down a little bit to meet their new targets at the end of this month, for example. Of course, the Philip Lowe conversation, not so much the normal release, but the media conference really put the cat among the pigeons in my mind.
It did. I mean, you've got Lowe, for better or worse, basically confirming that the way that the immigration driven growth model that we have has been suppressing wages, which, I mean, you'd think we'd be almost riotous at the fact that we've had something that has so clearly been, suppressing outcomes for Australian households for so long. But then one thing that really got me about what he was saying as well was that he said it would be wrong. Wrong was the word he used, to use interest rates to put downward pressure on home prices.
Yep.
Downward pressure on home prices growth more aptly. And, well, I got to say, I don't really find anything all that wrong about it.
Well, bearing in mind their own modelling showed that there was a very strong correlation between rate movements and prices. I think the modelling said if rates went down by 100 basis points over the long term, prices would go up 30%, right?
Yeah.
So the reverse is also true.
Well, one would imagine so. I mean, particularly, although you've almost got to look at it in a different perspective, in the sense that the amount that the rates will rise from such a low base, particularly when we have fixed rates that have been effectively, suppressed into oblivion. You know, I mean, you could still get a mortgage for 1.8, 1.9% for fixed for 3 years. And when those rates cease to exist in the coming years, or whenever that ends up happening, depending on the global economic environment, you could see variable rates jumped up to, 4%, 4.5% if some of the current futures market action and the interest rates futures are confirmed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the interest rate story is quite interesting because if you look at the markets overnight, they sort of dropped. And, people are saying, well, hang on a moment, is that just a technical issue to do with what I mentioned earlier on about the changes in Treasury issuance? Or is it that people are beginning to question whether, in fact, the boom in the US is going to be quite such a big boom? And, is the Delta virus going to basically crush the recovery? And there are also some other things, like some of those loan forgiveness programs, which were in place until the end of July and the end of September, are coming off. So you're going to see more exposure in the US to some of the households and some of the issues there. So people are beginning to say, maybe things aren't quite as bullish as we thought.
Well, it's a rather sort of complex thing in terms of, how it all interacts, the various credit impulses. Then you've also, as you say, got the Delta variant. But I think between China being much, much more frugal with the amount that it's borrowing, especially at a local and provincial government level, I think that combined with the Delta variant has basically already taken the global recovery to the woodshed. Don't get me wrong, we could see further stimulus in the US and further stimulus around the world, particularly in Europe, Australia, Canada, etc., where we have the scope for that stimulus. But in the developing world, the scope really isn't there in the same way that it was at the start of last year. So, I mean, I think in many ways the global recovery has already been taken out the back and shot. It's just the fact that we're going to see this distortion of all this stimulus and all these various central bank actions to suppress rates and everything else going on in the West. But in the rest of the world, in places say like Brazil, for example, which is still struggling badly with the virus, in some case, I think it had record cases just a few weeks ago. Interest rates have more than doubled in the last 12 months. And I mean, you know, they are literally, you know, all this central bank idiocy that we're seeing in the West is flowing through into the developing world and kicking them in at absolutely the worst possible time.
Absolutely. So the concept of the economy out the back twitching, having been shot right, is one that I find not at all enthusiastically, but I find quite convincing. Right? There are so many question marks, and as you say, as it flows over into the emerging markets, that's where we're going to see the cracks emerge first. And then, of course, you've got Boris in London saying, "Well, okay, well, we'll just unlock anything anywhere and hang everybody." I mean, I find that also an amazing, an attempt to, I'm not sure do quite what, but it does worry me that we seem to be making some really quite ad hoc and rather weird decisions at the moment.
Well, I understand why Boris is doing it, and for the moment, it seems like it is a, I don't know if the right word is appropriate, but I understand that these things need to be explored, that they need to see what works and what doesn't. And unfortunately, at some point, the rubber meets the road. But the reality is that, I mean, I get that, you know, Britain is one of the largest economies in the world, but when you really start to examine the data coming out of places like China, places like India, and even just look, if you look at the, say, like the Chinese credit impulse against, say, like global manufacturing, they track each other very, very strongly. And China is the engine of global growth, for better or worse. It is the engine that powers, particularly emerging markets. But you don't get the same effect when Biden throws another couple of trillion at people, because all that ends up happening is you end up with a backlog of container ships sitting off of Yanchan and Shanghai, sitting there waiting to load up all these goods that these Americans have bought on Amazon from China.
Absolutely. It is wacky, isn't it? And you have to sort of say, well, if things go less well than the markets were expecting and the markets start coming off, as possibly they will that then create further idiocy from central banks, to quote your phrase, right? Will they just do a little another round or two of quantitative easing where they can, which sort of goes further down the rabbit hole as far as I can see.
Well, I suppose the question is that will it actually work? I mean, in some ways, okay, like say for example the bond issue. I mean, the idea of quantitative easing is designed to drive down bond yields. But at the end of the day, if we are correct about this, and if we do see a less strong global recovery without further stimulus, then bond yields are going to drop all on their own. They're not going to need any help from Jerome Powell or Philip Lowe. They will head back to 2020 levels, you know, in relatively short order in the grand scheme of things anyway. But I mean, I think that they probably will throw more QE at the system, because that's you know, when you've only got one lever, that's what you do. You just keep pulling it more and more furiously, hoping it's going to work. But realistically, I don't really see that it will.
No, and it was interesting going back to that press conference on Tuesday. There were a whole bunch of luminaries and journalists from various flavors and also bank analysts, but none of them asked the important question of Philip Lowe, which is, how do you reverse this? How do you get out of the cul-de-sac that you've dug yourself into, right? Now, I don't know whether anybody was thinking that they should ask it, but nobody dared ask it.
Well, it's because it's impossible. It's quite literally impossible. I mean, you know, let's just play out a scenario for a moment. Let's say that the RBA cash rate goes back to even say like 2016, 2017 levels. The entire housing market, if you had that over, if you had rate rises to that effect up to 2016, 2017 levels over the course of say 12 to 18 months, the housing market would fall flat on its face, and we would have a massive recession. Because people would just stop spending, and as the, well, what would you call it? The wealth effect reverses. But at the end of the day, despite the pain and the challenges that would create, that's also the only way out of this.
Well, unless you go for a Steve Keen type debt jubilee, where somehow you reduce the debt burden and in some way maintain the equity in in people's houses so they don't feel too bad about it. But I mean, you'd have to have some unconventional alternatives, which of course are way beyond the ken of the central bank and the way that they think about this. And I guess one of their issues is that they've got this sort of single lever, right, called interest rates, right? And they're trying to sort of apply it to GDP, wages, employment, even migration to an extent, right? I mean, they're trying to sort of house prices. I mean, it's amazing to think they've got this single tool, essentially. And, not surprisingly, they sort of waggle it around and see where it goes. It doesn't necessarily end up where they think it's going to go to.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in some ways, it ends up exactly where they want it to go to. I mean, they know that cutting rates boosts housing prices. They knew that when they slashed rates last year. Sorry, when they slashed rates in 2019, and when they slashed rates again last year, they knew exactly what would happen. They're not idiots, you know. I mean, Peter Tulip's own research, I mean, he was the one who authored that paper about, how a 100 basis points drop in interest rates boosts housing prices by 30%. So they know that they're creating an absolute nightmare for people. They know that they're creating enormous levels of systemic risk, and they know that if rates rise by a similar amount down the road, once households have become comfortable with this and they've raised their spending accordingly, that it's going to create all sorts of problems. But I mean, that's the tomorrow RBA's problem, and the tomorrow RBA has a lot of problems.
Yeah. Well, they've given up forecasting, right? Because they're now saying they're going to sort of just wait and see where it goes. And, once inflation is hit, then we might do something, right? Rather than trying to predict it. Because, of course, it takes a long time. The lag time is quite interesting, right? So, if you start changing interest rates, it takes a long time to work through the economy to see whether it works all right. So they would try and predict it previously. And I think, as Alan Kohler wrote in the week, they got like 1,400 people in the Reserve Bank. About 400 of plus more of them are pure economists. What are they doing there if they're not making any predictions? Interesting question.
They have 400 economists, and they've managed to stuff up wage growth forecasts this badly for this long. Jeez, I got to say, I mean, I think we're at monkey with a dartboard levels of, wow! I didn't know it was that many. I would have thought, it was one guy who was chained to his desk in the basement of Martin Place coming up with wage forecasts.
Well, maybe there is an economist down in the basement next to the heater, right? But no, according to Alan Kohler, it's hundreds.
Oh wow, that's interesting. I mean, although I mean, I suppose it really just goes to show how the sort of the ideology of modern central banks just spreads. Well, it spreads like the zombification of the economy. I mean, you just end up with these ideas that have no real relevance in the real world and pay little heed to the damage that they do. I mean, they all just put their hands over their ears and hum very loudly, and then just forget about the fact that they've created the largest increase in wealth inequality in without say like violence. I mean, obviously you could say Caesar going around Rome knocking people off and taking all their gold and stuff like that, or Henry VIII robbing the church. But in terms of a non-violent, non sort of properly state-sanctioned wealth confiscation, you've seen the largest increase in inequality in the history of man, thanks to
Absolutely.
them.
Absolutely. And it's interesting. I spoke to Michael Hudson, the famous economist, just over a year ago, and he was making precisely this point that the basic philosophical structure that central banks are using tilts the playing field such that more and more people are basically left out, and that the value of the economy rises to the very small proportion of people who do really well, but the rest of the economy just doesn't. And of course, what you end up doing is burdening with more and more debt. That just basically means that they have to run faster and faster and faster to stand still. And one of the other things that came out this last week was that because of the amount of debt now in the system, even a small increase in interest rates would effectively put the same sort of pressure on people that perhaps a 3 or 4% rise would have created some time back. So we've got this really precarious situation, and that's the thing that I don't think people have understood, just how precarious people's finances are at the moment. 41% in financial stress, mortgage stress at the moment in my surveys, right? They're precarious, and small movements can have significant and profound impacts. And of course, small movements like suddenly being locked down for a week or two, or more small businesses, you know, disappearing because they are now not able to trade. Those are the things that can have huge impact now.
Well, that's really what we mean by the title of this video, the perfect storm. And it's also the fact that as it currently stands, you know, overnight interbank futures, which is the benchmark which they use to set forward guidance on rates in the market, you're looking at something like, I think it's 6 rate hikes in the next 4 years. And that is the perfect storm that we're currently seeing, because even if we don't see wage growth, even if we don't see the truly inflationary pressures that are actually going to underpin long-term inflation, you're still going to see all these supply chain issues. You're still going to see all these other problems basically just created by this enormous stimulus that's still feeding through the economy as people spend their savings. And as, well, we may see even more stimulus, particularly in the US later this year, as all that feeds through, you're going to have these inflationary impulses that's going to continue long past, in my view, long past, you know, the sort of very short-term, you know, transitory period that the RBA and the Fed refuse to quantify what it actually is.
In a way, they've convinced the market, haven't they, predominantly, that it's transitory and, you know, short-term.
I actually agree with them in principle. I completely wholeheartedly agree with them. Yes, I agree they will be transitory, and we will see a return to you know, the broader deflationary forces. And that's what we've seen overnight in the US and in the bond market. But that's pricing things years and years into the future. In the short term, we've still got to resolve all these various issues with supply chain disruptions, inflationary pressures, et cetera, before we can get to that deflationary future. And I think that's what a lot of people need to understand, that, you know, it's not necessarily one or the other. It could be both.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as I often remind people, really low interest rates are intrinsically deflationary, right? And low levels of inflation are intrinsically deflationary because wages just don't track it, right? And then we've got the situation still where we know that some costs of some things are rising very fast, wages aren't. And so if you believe that the leading indicator of inflation is actually wages growth, and Lowe is saying wages growth ain't going anywhere for the next few years, migration may or may not help, depending on which way you read that argument, right? It's interesting to think how this plays out. And as you say, not just over 6 months, you've got to be thinking a few years here.
Yeah, well, 2, 3, 4 years ahead. I mean, it's a really, you know, because these things take time. They take time to feed through the economy, and even little things like supply chain issues, because sometimes it can take 6 weeks, depending on the number of port calls or how fast the ship is moving, to ship something from, say from Shanghai to Rotterdam, which is one of the busiest shipping routes in the world. It takes time for these things to feed in. And not only that, but say, for example, the stuff that you're thinking of buying at the Black Friday sales now, they're needing to get that shipped out of China yesterday to get it all ready into the system, into the warehouses and into the stores. All these things take time, and that's something that's really unappreciated by the market, because I don't think the broader market realizes how stretched the global logistics chain is and how much that is actually going to impact things for the foreseeable future.
Mm. Well, the jury, container index is still very high, and that's an important lead indicator of shipping costs. And of course, Australia is particularly exposed to it, right? Because we bring most of the stuff in either by air or by sea.
Well, and that's an important point as well, because, you know, we could see even worse inflationary pressures than the US, because we do have to import so much, because we do have to import things by sea. And it's also the fact that we don't have Canada and Mexico and NAFTA, which is the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, you know, sort of facilitates trade within that particular sphere, which is often done by road and rail. We're reliant on shipping. But just to, you know, sort of go into a little bit more detail, I think that there's just a real quandary on the horizon for the global economy, because all this stuff is not going to be resolved swiftly in the way that the market wants it to be. But by the same token, you know, for anyone watching this, we don't know if that's going to matter. Like, that's the strange thing.
Now that's exactly right. Yeah, what really is important in terms of those market dynamics is, of course, a very interesting question. Then you have to say, well, who are the main actors, right? And of course, you've got states, and you've got very large, global financial corporations who are certainly calling a lot of the shots at the moment. A lot of them are also taking very speculative positions as well in terms of placing a bet on where they think the markets will go, and a lot of them are making more money at the moment from the volatility than they are from underlying activities, I notice. So there's a lot of uncertainty in terms of how this is actually going to, develop over the next little while. And I just wonder, coming back to how much power do central banks really have, and how much power do governments really have to shape this now, or has it basically got a momentum of its own?
Well, I think it's an interesting question because it really depends on how you approach it. If you approach it from a purely, sort of mathematical Newtonian nuts and bolts type thing, where you just purely assess how things would interact on a mathematical level without, the sort of broader human factor, okay, there's probably a fair bit more scope, because you can, for example, do infrastructure-based stimulus or stimulus that targets, business and job creation or any number of different things. They are all options out there. But the problem at the moment is, why would you invest in that when you can invest in stocks? Because the Fed will save us, the Fed will save us, the Fed will save us. It's the psychology of the market more than anything. Like, I mean, say corporate the Fed's corporate bond purchases, for example. That's a perfect example of the way the market psychology has played out. Because the Fed only bought a handful of corporate bonds. It was a tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of the market, like less than 1%. And just the Fed saying that they would buy them, that they would, and in the words of Jerome Powell, make investors whole. That in itself was enough to underpin the market, the corporate bond market. And we've seen even junk bond yields go to their lowest levels in history. Junk bond yields today are yielding less than what investment grade bonds from actual good companies were yielding a couple of years ago. So we've got this completely broken price discovery mechanism. And the truth is, you just don't know where it's going to end because it's all based on I mean, it's a con job, really. Con as in confidence. Because if as long as people believe that that's what's going to happen, then that's what will happen. But then, obviously, when those beliefs start to fray, that's when things get interesting.
Yeah, and a little analogy on that was the chartists. The chartists are the ones who look at all of these shapes on the charts and then say, oh, look, that's a double top, double bottom, or a trombone or whatever it is, right? And the interesting question with those sorts of things is, do they become self-perpetuating, right, and self-fulfilling, right? Because if you actually believe it's going to be X, then you do Y, and that means it's going to actually come out with the answer you expect. So in some way, they may not be predictive at all.
No, but I mean, I suppose that's the problem. Just by the very act of observing something and commentating on it, you end up in affecting the outcome. So that's really, I mean, trying to quantify that is basically impossible, at least with the sort of computing power and our understanding of things as they are. But I don't know. I think that we're just in for a really, really interesting time in terms of the interest rate, the tapering debate. Because you've seen data in China, in India, in the US miss to the downside in a big, big way. Like two, three sigma events, things that are only meant to happen once every couple of hundred or even every couple of thousand years, that are all of a sudden happening with alarming regularity.
Yeah, I think it's a flock of black swans, right? Or whatever the collective noun for black swans is.
Pretty much. And that's really where we're at the moment because like after $24 trillion in new debt over the last 12 months, I think it's actually might actually be more than that now at this point, but around about $24 trillion in new debt. Everyone's saying the market's fantastic, the data's fantastic. Yeah, don't get me wrong, the data's pretty good. You look at manufacturing indexes in the Western world, you look at Germany, you look at the US, they're all, they're pretty impressive, don't get me wrong. But for $24 trillion, they damn well better be the best data that you've ever seen. And it isn't.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a lot of money, and what have we really got for it? And of course, this coming week, we're going to see more data out of China, which will be quite interesting to see what that that is going to look like? Because I think that, you know, we've said, I think, in previous shows that China is a very important leading indicator here of how this is all going to play out. And some of the data there is not particularly good.
No, and there is one thing that I would like to add to that, that there is a lot of confusion surrounding the Chinese services index, because there's the Caxton services index, and then there's the Chinese government's non-manufacturing index, which is basically generally referred to as the Chinese government's own services index. Now, while they sound like they're the same, they're not. The Chinese non-manufacturing index, aka the Chinese government services index, actually includes things like construction and construction services. So it ends up distorting it to all oblivion when the Chinese government steps on the infrastructure and real estate construction accelerator pedal, which creates rather a misleading, you know, a rather misleading picture of what's actually going on for Chinese consumers, who are actually very much pulling back and holding back on their spending and being more frugal, which is exactly what the Chinese government doesn't want. This is just what we're talking about. Yeah. The Chinese data is, as you can see, well and truly past its peak. The services PMI actually peaked all the way back in the middle of 2020 after the Chinese economy reopened. And now even the manufacturing PMI is well past its peak by date. So we've got a really interesting thing going on in China, where the China's very much showing what the road ahead actually looks like. Once that stimulus feeds through, everything is looking a whole lot weaker. And I also think it's important to keep in mind that this is what we're seeing in China after all that trillions of stimulus in the US flowed into Chinese manufacturers. It's still not exactly the stellar data that you'd be thinking. The data that sort of defined China during the period immediately following the GFC, and when they, you know, really hit the accelerator pedal on stimulus.
Yeah, very interesting. And you know, we've said, I think, on a few occasions that what happens in China has profound impacts for the Australian economy, as well as, of course, the broader economy. And you know, the global situation is that we have a lot of consumers in many countries all consuming stuff out of China. But if that goes slow, then China's going to be under significant pressure.
Absolutely. And this is the Chinese credit impulse against global manufacturing PMI's new orders. And you can see that, you know, the historic relationship is quite strong. Once you see the Chinese manufacturing index, sorry, the Chinese credit impulse peak, and obviously this is lagged, but you see global new export orders just start to fall rather significantly. And the Chinese credit impulse has rolled over already, and it's going even lower. And while we may see some impact from the Biden stimulus, from other various stimuluses that are to come, it's very difficult to be able to overcome such a large driver of marginal growth and just manufacturing in general. I mean, you know, China is the manufacturing hub for the world, for better or worse.
Absolutely.
Now, despite the fact that we saw quite strong yields in US bonds and even in European bonds towards the start of this year, Chinese bonds actually peaked and started rolling over in November last year in terms of yields. And they've since just continued to go further and further down as Chinese investors and just global investors in general price in weaker Chinese growth and weaker Chinese inflation.
That's significant, isn't it? I hadn't realized it really started back in November, but yeah, there's a consistent trend.
Yeah, there is. It's quite interesting because this is roughly when you started to see the peak of all the various indices in China, and Chinese investors aren't having a bar of the whole, you know, reflation narrative and all the rest of it. They've just said no, not happening. I think they get along very well with Steve Van Meter.
I think you're right.
And you know, we've seen US yields follow. You know, I believe they peaked in March, and we've seen them slowly trend lower until about a little over a week ago, where they really started to fall off a cliff. And we saw them go from around about 1.5%, almost 1.5% about a week ago, down to as low as 1.25% last night, which for the bond market is an absolutely huge move. It's not like stocks where you see things move quite rapidly. Bonds tend to move quite a lot slower. And the question is that, you know, is this a sustained move down, or, you know, are we going to see a bounce? Personally, I think we should see a bounce here, because mostly because if they don't bounce here, it's, you know, it's a big deal, because that's exactly what happened during the 2020 crash.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, watch this space. I think the bonds is always leading the way, and Steve would say, you know, watch the bonds, everything follows. Okay, so Credit Impulse is pointing to weaker long-term inflation. Yeah, that's a very important slide.
Yeah, no, I quite like this one. All right, so we've got the G5 Credit Impulse, which is basically the global credit impulse for all intents and purposes. And as you can see, US inflation expectations tend to track this relatively closely. And while we've still got, I think, probably quite a little bit more to go potentially in terms of where the US inflation expectations head, as you can see, once that begins to roll over, we could see, deflation even.
Yes.
And obviously that this is based on how things are now, and obviously there are a lot of other things that could impact that going forward, you know, future issues with supply chains due to the virus, or just more stimulus from Biden and Yellen.
Yeah, and the point is about here, of course, and you know, you will understand. I tend to be on the deflationary side of things because you've got to ask the other question is. Well, you know, how much credit is there? And the other question is, well, where's it all going anyway? And is it going into the real economy, or is it going into financial markets and those sort of things? Because actually, all that any credit that flows into the financial market isn't necessarily going to have any inflationary impact either.
No, and part of the problem as well, just, you know, it's good that you mentioned that, is that a lot of this credit these days, if it used to be if credit flowed into corporates, say back in the 70s or the 80s, they would use that credit to then grow the business. They would, you know, they'd use that credit to build a new factory or to innovate or to do research and development. While in this day and age, more often than not, it just goes to share buybacks, which really does bugger all in terms of inflation or growth
Well,
for that
yeah, well,
matter.
actually, what it does, it allows zombie companies to continue to exist, right? And it also means that you can't necessarily look at the real returns of those companies and the real share prices because they're artificially maintained.
Yeah, exactly. All right, I'll just move this a little so we can all see. Meanwhile, you've got the prices paid sub-index of the US ISM Manufacturing Index at its highest level since 1979, which is, frankly, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. I mean, Jimmy Carter was president, you know, Ronald Reagan was still known as a movie star and the governor of California at that point. And it's interesting because these price pressures aren't really going away as swiftly as central banks would like, which is a key part, I think, of what we could see in terms of pressure on the Fed and on the RBA to potentially raise rates if this does feed through into CPI inflation.
Yep. And of course, the way that CPI is measured, some of this would probably hit the CPI numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, especially considering how, you know, not accurate, well, not representative, not fully representative the CPI the various CPIs can be.
Oh, really? Oh, I'm surprised. Not.
then we've got, as you were mentioning earlier, the shipping costs, and they're heading for the moon. There's no real respite. They just keep heading higher and higher. Now, I've heard from some people in the shipping industry, and if you're talking about trying to get a 40-foot container at the last minute on a route, say like Shanghai or Yanchan to Rotterdam or to Los Angeles, I've heard of people paying up to $20,000, $20,000 for shipping at the last minute. And that is just that. I mean, while you can fit a lot in a 20-foot container, it's getting to the point now where we are going to start seeing these higher shipping costs feed into pretty much everything, particularly goods that are relatively large. You know, things like, you know, white goods and stuff like that that takes up quite a lot of space, rather than, you know, you're not going to see that much inflation as a result of shipping costs on the cost of a Kit Kat.
But a JCB or something like that. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
And this is a good one to end on. It's a chart that really speaks for itself. It shows that on an annualized basis, flows into equity markets have been higher on an annualized basis in the first half of this year than the last 20 years combined. And that really just sort of breaks your brain, because it really makes you wonder how much cash is actually left on the sidelines.
Mm. Well, but ask yourself also this, Tarek, where has a lot of that cash come from, right? I refer to my earlier answer, right? It's credit.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and you look at margin debt at absolutely record highs. I mean, I believe, what was the latest margin debt count? I think someone said on Twitter the other day about $850 billion.
Yeah, that's probably about right. It's probably even higher than that now. I mean, there's a huge amount of leveraged debt. And interestingly, one other thing I want to highlight is, have you noticed the range of private equity firms now taking swipes at, corporates around the world where their share prices are languishing a bit? And you wonder where that money's come from.
You do. I mean, I wish I knew really. It's really quite interesting, because we haven't really seen the large scale outflows out of bonds and other assets that you perhaps might would have expected if we were seeing this under more normal circumstances.
Mm. Although one of the things I would add there is, I wonder how many of those are now selling their cryptos.
Well, that's another one too. I mean, it's really quite interesting just watching the market at this point, because it's being propped up by a very, very small number of companies. You know, you look at like the advanced decline on the Dow or on the NASDAQ, and it's just being propped up by such a small number of companies who don't get me wrong, who are doing very, very well. But when you look at other things, say like the Russell 2000 small cap index in the US or the Dow Transport Index or the Nikkei in Japan, which is in not fantastic shape, you know, it tells a very different story.
Absolutely, it does. I'm just going to put you back full screen.
Yep, no worries. I'll just stop share.
Yep, thank you. Great. Yep. Let's remove your duplicate self. You only need one. Yeah, no, very interesting. And you know, the fascinating thing about all of these stories is that the real uncertainty, you know, I keep saying to people, you know, you've got to understand the level of uncertainty that we're seeing, you know, around at the moment is probably as high as it's ever been.
Yeah, well, it's there or it's not far off. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't. I mean, I honestly find it just, I'm flabbergasted by the fact that if you watch some of the, you know, you watch Bloomberg, you watch CNBC, you see all, you know, the parade of talking heads, and you see these so many folks. And don't get me wrong, there are some great people on there who make some fantastic points, but too often you see people just saying that everything's going to be fantastic, that, you know, basing it on this data that's so incredibly distorted by $24 trillion in global stimulus, that it just bears very, very little resemblance to reality. And to be completely frank, I also find it a little bit Western-centric in this idea that we're all going to be fine, that the rest of the world's struggling, getting smashed by the virus, getting hit by inflation, rising interest rates, that somehow doesn't matter.
No.
You know, I mean, globalization cuts both ways.
And it's worth just reflecting on this, you know, around 20% of the global economy would sit in what I would class as sort of, you know, Western neoliberal world space, right? Which means that 80% isn't, right?
Yeah.
And most of that 80% is in the developing world, or underdeveloped world, rather than actually, you know, the sort of the 20% that we're part of. And in fact, we're a minority sport, if you think of it like that.
Well, we are. I mean, we are. And I think it's also important to emphasize too that it's that while, you know, we even in Australia, we represent like a decent small chunk, I should say, and that, you know, like the West represents a rather sizable chunk of the global economy. I think it's also important to keep in mind that in terms of actual growth levels, we're not the driver of the global economy, and we haven't been for quite some time.
Yeah, well, the demographic shifts, right? If you look at that, we've got more of the population aging, as the intergenerational report showed quite recently. Most Western economies are doing somewhat similar things. Most of the growth in population is coming from the other parts of the world, which have very different sets of parameters attached to them. And it sort of just, raises the question, well, play this ahead 20, 30 years, what's the world going to look like then?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it actually brings me back to something that a Greek friend of mine said to me. A Greek friend who actually moved to the United States after the financial crisis because, well, that's where the jobs are, And it's interesting, and they just said I would rather go through something temporary that's painful than live like we have in Greece over the last, 8 or 9 years. Because, and that's what we're doing. We're signing up to be Greece, basically, as a collective in the West. Because, where is the growth going to come from? We're relying entirely on stimulus. We're relying on, hoping against hope that somehow businesses are going to borrow. And okay, maybe they will, but it's not going to be the sort of stellar thing that people are expecting. And I just worry that we're just, instead of just taking the medicine, taking the pain now, dealing with it for a couple of years, deleveraging and then coming out better on the other side, that we're just signing up to be Greece and just, being on life support forever and ever. I mean, and if you actually look at a chart of Greek GDP, it's never ever recovered. It's still like 20, 30% below where it was pre-financial crisis.
Yeah, well, I've said, I think, on previous shows, Japan is probably a precursor to where we could get to, but Japan could turn into Greece, so yeah, absolutely. And look, the other point, and this is something I'm going to get on my high horse, right? Don't often do, but I will. This concept of perpetual growth, right? We have a finite planet, we have finite resources. Maybe that isn't the most flawed assumption that we actually make, not just you and I, but effectively everybody around the world, that we can go on growing and growing and growing. Maybe we've got to actually redesign the way we think about things for a much more stable use of the resources on the planet, or maybe even degrowth.
But well, that raises an interesting point in terms of Japan, because everyone goes on about, oh, Japan lost decade, blah, 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 blah. But if you actually look at it in per capita terms, Japan has had Australia has had a worse lost decade than Japan, in terms of outcomes for households. So really, I people say, oh, it's so horrible to turn out like Japan. Really, no, I don't think so. I think turning out like Japan wouldn't be too bad relative to the other options, to be completely honest with you.
Well, that's true. And of course, the central bank in Japan owns probably more of the economy there than, here. Although Philip Lowe said they'll hold 30% of all the government debt, plus 15% of the state debt in Australia by November if they run it forward. It's quite a lot.
It is, and we are. I mean, I did a little bit of rough math the other day, and I mean, we're buying, a sort of similar degree of issuance. The RBA, should I say, is buying a similar degree of issuance of net bond issuance to the ECB buying the Greek bonds. I mean, our bond market is so absurdly manipulated, it's just not funny.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why it's not more notable. I mean, we are on a path at the moment whereby I'm fairly certain that by the end of this, the RBA will own a greater proportion of federal debt than the Fed does of US debt.
I think it's
And the
quite likely.
Fed's been at it for 13 years.
Yeah.
We've been at it
Yeah.
for 18 months.
Well, we're just coming late and going in boots and all, right? And we'll probably go on doing it beyond when the Fed, eases, if they do ease, because effectively some of the parameters here are going to be more extreme.
Well, I just wonder what exactly are we going to do? Okay, I mean, let's say they taper. I mean, they've tapered from 5 billion a week down to 4 billion a week. And let's say in November they taper it down to 3 billion a week. But and if the economy is doing it anyway decently, they're going to be buying more than 100% of net issuance anyway. So at what point do we just say, oh, do we even have a bond market anymore? Or if you want to buy a bond, you've actually just got to ring up Philip Lowe.
Yeah, just go straight to the RBA, cut out the middleman.
But apparently you can't do that. If you go full debt monetization, that's apparently blatantly wrong, but I mean, look, I don't think we should be doing any of this. I mean, I think QE is an absolute freaking joke, to be completely honest with you. It doesn't even work. If you actually look at the bond yields during QE and then tapering, they rise during QE and then they fall during tapering.
Yes. Explain. We need some new economists with a new way of thinking. Now,
Yeah,
just
one that's
before
actually correct.
yeah, exactly right. Yeah, we should go and change some of those 400 and get some with a different mindset. Trouble is, of course, they all have groupthink, and in fact, a number of independent observers say the problem is that all of those economists think the same way. So that they've caught in this trap along with the Treasury and everybody else. Right? They're all thinking the same, myopic way of trying to deal with the problem.
It's really quite unfortunate because there are a lot of great Australian economists out there. There are a lot of people who understand these particular issues, who understand all these problems in a much, much more in-depth and in a way that's much more relevant to the average person on the street. And it's a shame that these people don't have more power to be able to influence actual real change. Instead, we just get, the RBA and the federal government just pumping housing prices to the moon because that's what they've always done.
Absolutely, yes. Well, pump, pump, pump a bit. Let's put the house price up a bit further. And of course, you can't let them fall because then that means the banks have issues, which means we have a financial crisis, and so it goes on. Now, just before we finish today, I just want your reflections on ScoMo's or Scott Morrison's announcement about suddenly the more vaccines are coming.
Well, there isn't actually more coming. The same amount's coming. Yes, I mean, I don't know if we're getting them any earlier, but it's still part of the same 40 million that we ordered from Pfizer in the first place. So no, they're not. There isn't any more coming, unfortunately. It'd be nice if there was, but it's not.
No, and the reason I raise this is because it's another example of the old spin machine in action, isn't it?
Well, interestingly, well, you got to hand it to them. I mean, they've got a masterful spin machine. I mean, it's impressive. And I think of the what's even more impressive is the fact that it's still working. I mean, Australians just don't really seem to be bothered by it. I mean,
No, no.
ScoMo lies, no one cares. And I mean, apparently there was a study done the other day, a poll of Australians that said 95% of people said that if a politician's lie, that they should resign. And I'm just sitting there thinking, well, who would we have left?
Yes, it seems to be part of the training now.
Unfortunately, and I think in a lot of ways, we end up with the government we deserve because if we put up with this, I mean, it's like Simon Birmingham, the cabinet minister on the television the other day, getting interviewed on, I think it might have been the ABC, and basically he just said, you knew what you were getting when we did all this stuff with these car parks, with it all not being done properly, with it all not being done based on the business case or based on an independent analysis. And we just, it's just MPs looking out for their local communities. And, if we accept that, then we're complicit, not complicit, that's the wrong word, but we're approving of that. We're approving of that type of misuse of public funds.
Well, it's the same as Gladys in New South Wales some time ago. Same thing. That's just the way the politics is, They will throw money out to local communities to influence some decisions. That's just the nature of the game. Well, to my mind, we need a new game then.
Well, we do, but the problem is that the reaction of the public is just further incentivized that type of behavior and that type of decision making. Because, I mean, realistically, after all the mistakes Morrison's made, if we had a hawk like, someone, an opposition leader like Bob Hawke, he would have got torn to shreds. That's really the long and the short of it. Someone who knew how to play the media a lot better, someone who was able to more aggressively attack but not be seen as being, overly aggressive, but being as being like somewhat fair in the way, someone like Hawke would have torn ScoMo to shreds on the floor of Parliament with a smile and a laugh, and then the papers the next day would have had a good chuckle about it. But there really isn't that type of politician anymore.
No, we are definitely in a different season, a stormy season, to quote the quote the title of this video. But unfortunately, it is true we get the politicians that we deserve, and unfortunately, too many Australians are not sufficiently engaged around those critical issues and just seems to go past to the keeper.
I mean, you can't blame them entirely. You know, I think that would be a bit, you know, sort of unfair, but it's just, if you look at the level of confidence Australians have in their politicians, if you go back to say prior to the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd era, it was actually relatively high. And that's showed in the Australian election survey. But if you look at what's happened since, it's just gone down the toilet. And it just, in a lot of ways, it just keeps getting worse. And I mean, I think that the Australian public has become awfully forgiving of politicians' mistakes. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that in principle. You know, if a politician gets up and says, okay, I'm really, really sorry. I've made a mistake. I went in with the best of intentions and I was just trying to do what's best for the Australian people. I think that we could all sit back and we could go, yeah, okay, fair enough. But when you refuse to admit that you've made a mistake and you just double down as the Prime Minister and as other people do, I don't know. I think that we should just hold them to a higher standard.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, the whole concept of not accepting any weakness, not accepting any, you know, criticism and just shouting louder. That's sort of what happens in the playground, isn't it?
It is, but the problem is that it actually works both in politics and on the playground. If there's no one to if there's no one to step in, the bully, if no one steps in or steps up, the bully wins. No. You know, that's how it works on the playground.
No, you're right.
And, I mean, and one of the things that just gets me while we're on the topic of politics is look at the US. You know, people say, oh, but you know, Trump's gone now, and I just feel like saying he won an election. He almost won a second election. He lied. He did all these different various things. I mean, don't get me wrong. There are some items of Trump's agenda that I wholeheartedly support, like confronting China more strongly, or actually giving a crap about jobs going offshore. At least giving the appearance of that anyway. And I think Trump deserves a lot of credit for that. I think he even deserves credit for the vaccine rollout in some ways, you know. And I think that we need to be fair. But by the same token, someone of that character never would have got close to the White House 20 or 30 years ago. Mm. And I think that's where we're at now. Even with Morrison, I don't think Morrison would have got close to the lodge 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, you know, there's a thing called a moral compass, right? And I know that's old fashioned, and you know, I can say it because I'm old, right? But you know, in the day, there was a set of moral underpinning of what people were doing and why they were doing it, right? I think that unfortunately is on the blink, right? I think it's just going round in circles, the moral compass, and I'm not sure that anybody really cares anymore.
No, they don't. They don't. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, if there was a more effective opposition here, maybe that would bother people more, if they were able to ram home the problems in the same way that, say, you know, Tony Abbott ceaselessly rammed home the real, you know, the rhetoric around the carbon tax and all those other things. But I mean, I think it's a problem where there are no real easy answers, because it's just so easy to just sit back to just, you know, do nothing and just hope that more money rains from the sky. And I suppose in a way I sort of understand that we've been quite lucky here, you know, over the last 18 months. But I think that we also need to assign responsibility both in terms of the successes and the failures.
Absolutely. Well, you know, money raining from the sky is where we are at the moment. They'll just do a bit more quantitative easing and they'll throw a bit more money here and there and everywhere and an attempt to win the next election. But as we've, you know, coming to the end of this show, some of this is not necessarily taking us to where we need to go to. And, you know, I worry about whether, in fact, we have the right settings and the right compass to take us forward. But I guess we'll see as this plays out.
Yeah, well, pretty much. I mean, that's really all you can do. And if there's one thing I just sort of want to end on in all of this, is that, you know, there are sort of some positive things going on. You know, don't get me wrong. You know, it's good that most of Australia has been able to live their relatively normal life throughout the vast majority of this pandemic. And that's absolutely fantastic. And I think it is important to remember those positive things. But yep. I think it is also important to remember that the average person in Sydney can't come up with all this extra money every day just to keep their deposit the same size, because it's freaking impossible. And oh yeah, I'm just going to pull 6 grand a month out of nowhere just to maintain the size of my deposit. And I think it's really, really ridiculously unfair that that isn't mentioned more, particularly in the context now of people being stuck in lockdown and not being able to save, let alone, do anything else.
Absolutely. Well, I'll just mention before we go your recent article on news.com.au, which again was specifically about the trajectory of house prices and what was driving it. That was a very, very good article. So I recommend people go look at it.
Oh, thanks, Martin. Appreciate it.
And I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts once again. As always, always very, very important themes that we touch on. And, I guess the message for everybody is it ain't straightforward. But
No.
Stormy times could be ahead, I think, for a little while. And I actually still think, we'll be talking about this for a little while, but I think by September the markets will be probably telling us rather something rather different from today. So we'll see.
No, well, hopefully we see some sanity return to the market rather than just, the Fed will save us, printer go brew.
Indeed. Thank you, Tarek. Have a great afternoon, and we'll catch you next time.
No worries, Martin. Catch you later.
Cheers. Bye-bye.